Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. My name is Boris Chassaigne. I'll be with you for the next half hour. We'll start things off today with two stories from British Columbia, where a string of bare human conflicts shake the province.
Last night we had one residence in the vicinity of where this happened that had their garage door completely ripped off the side of the building, so causing property damage as well.
The BC government will be spending a one-time $60 million envelope to help families who are struggling with inflation. The CRFC radio in Ontario will turn 100 in a few weeks. One of its volunteers has been on air for 40 years. He's a jazz buff and we'll spend some time with him.
40 years gone by, you wonder, all of the whys come into the picture. Why am I staying? Why? Really, the big why is sending out music to people who blues is music of truth and the music of healing. My aim was to bring music that was somewhat current and aimed toward the student body that I was broadcasting for. I'm so pleased that I'm able to participate in something like this and the 100th anniversary.
And through our Periscope, we'll take a peek of what's going on in Quebec, Ontario, and the northwestern part of British Columbia. Nice to have you with us.
Hi, I'm Sarah Gouda in Halifax, Nova Scotia. You are tuned to Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca and follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJR.
Our first stop will be in British Columbia, where the provincial government announced on August 29 that it will help families in need of financial support. The province is spending $60 million on a one-time student family affordability fund. And every school district in BC gets a share. The Revelstoke School District will get $250,000 to support lower-income families. The school district just needs to figure out how to best spend it now. In Revelstoke, BC, here's Megan Dooling.
Government announced on August 29th that every school district would get some money. This is pretty amazing, said Roberta Kubek. Revelstoke School District's new superintendent was speaking on Wednesday evening during the first school board meeting of the new school year. Kubek said the funding is a way to help families who are especially struggling with the high cost of living right now. The money isn't meant to be spent across the board. It has to specifically target underfunded students. It has to enhance programs already in place, like food programs, sports, field trips, or fees for classes. It can be used to help students who need equipment for sports. The province is allowing us to be creative, Kubek said, although she said the guidelines are constantly changing and they're trying to clarify how the money can be spent. Kubek said they will work with community groups to try and target people in need. They've met already with an Indigenous Friendship Society representative and will seek advice from the District Parent Advisory Council and other groups. Trustee Alan Chell said, "This is really good news," and wondered if the school board should form a committee with representatives from the schools in Revelstoke and the community. Chell also thought it would be a good idea to work with other districts to see how they're spending the money. Trustee Elmore Rorsted said, with the cost of food, breakfast programs could absolutely be expanded, maybe into lunch programs. He said food programs are uber important. In total, the province put $60 million into this one-time fund.
That was Megan Dooling. We stay in British Columbia, where a string of bear human conflicts in Nelson, BC has led to at least 12 bears being euthanized, say local conservation officers. The latest encounter took place on Vernon Street in downtown Nelson when customers at the Empire Coffee Shop saw a black bear in a tree in the middle of the street during the morning rush. In Nelson, our journalist John Roon speaks with conservation officer Nathan Smink, who shares his thoughts on the latest string of bear encounters.
It was a fully habituated food-conditioned bear. Last night we had one residence in the vicinity of where this happened that had their garage door completely ripped off the side of their the building, so causing property damage as well.
It was early Friday morning that customers at Nelson's Empire Coffee saw the latest in a string of recent bear conflicts in the West Kootenays from a front seat row. Conservation officer Nathan Smink said the bear was spotted in a tree in the middle of Vernon Street when police sectioned off a portion of the road so that Smink and his colleagues could shoot a tranquilizer dart into the animal, sending it to the ground. The bear was later euthanized. It's the 12th time that this happens in Nelson this year, and in Castlegar, six bears have met the same fate in 2022.
Since I've been back in Nelson since 2014, this is the busiest year for bears within the community. Could be a food issue, it could be a bear abundance issue.
But most of all, it's a matter of what the community can do, Smink says.
People need to step up and deal with their attractants better, whether that's having garbage taken away more than just every 2 weeks from their house, taking fruit sometimes when it's green. But all these things, they kind of accumulate into bear conflict.
British Columbia has some of the highest populations of black bears in the world, with estimates ranging from 120 to 150,000 animals, according to provincial estimates. That's about one quarter of all black bears in Canada. With those numbers and an increased activity, Smink says he wishes there was another way to deal with the problem than to euthanize them.
As for a control method, I'm dictated by what the experts in the field say, so the biologists and our policy. And as soon as we've got a bear that's completely food conditioned and causing property damage, whether it's pulling siding off of a house, pushing on doors to get into a building, getting into buildings, my hands are tied.
Reporting in Nelson, John Roon.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Canada's longest-running campus radio station is honoring long-standing volunteers as it celebrates 100 years of broadcasting. On October 7th, one of our partner stations, such as this one, CRFC 101.9 FM, will celebrate 100 years of broadcasting from Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, with a plaque unveiling ceremony. Queen's University archives will showcase selected CRFC memorabilia and photographs. CRFC will also honor two volunteers who have been on air for over 40 consecutive years, Jim Birch, host of Canadian Shield, and Wayne Vermette, host of The Blues Project. Vermette, who has been with CRFC for 41 years, says he has met two of his goals: to be on air for more than four decades and to be part of the 100th anniversary celebrations. Karen Musna spent some time in the company of Wayne Vermette, who hosts The Blues Project every Saturday night from 6 to 8 p.m. on CRFC 101.9.
Do you remember the first time you walked in here?
I do. The first time was with a neighbor friend of mine who was doing a jazz show at the station, and he invited me to sit in. And so I came to the station and listened to him go on for maybe half an hour or so, and he said, "Wayne, would you like to participate?" And I felt, well, being a salesman, I shouldn't be shy of speaking up, and so I said, "Sure, I'll do that." And so he gave me a record jacket three artists actually that were on this, Dave Brubeck. And he said, "All I'm going to do is at the end of the song, introduce you quickly, and you just say the names of the artists that were playing on this album." And I thought, well, that's fair enough. And I was nervous a little bit. But anyway, he handed me the jacket and the song was over and he said, "Okay, here's Wayne Vermette." And I said, "Good evening. I just wanted to tell you that the artist that you listened to, and I'll name them with the instrument, Dave Brubeck on piano. I forget the other gentleman at the moment.
Paul Desmond.
That's it.
On Paul, saxophone.
Saxophone. And who's the third guy?
I'll have to look that one up."
Anyways, I said, whoever his name was, on bass. Okay?
Okay.
So we left it at that. And he said, "Thank you, Wayne." And he cut us off, and he's laughing like heck because he said, "Wayne, it's not a fish. It's bass." So that was my knowledge of musical instruments and so on. This is back in 80. Don't forget that. It was just fresh, fresh, fresh. So anyway, that was my beginning. And after that, I accompanied him a few more times, probably a good months like go by, and Steve Cutway was the manager at the time. And Ian Byers was the program director. And so we got along quite well, the three of us, and I was invited to be a broadcaster if you want to take a slot. I said, what is it? And he said, jazz. And to me, jazz was big band. I thought, oh, well, that's great, because I grew up in my very early young years as a lover of jazz. So I said, I'll do it. So the slot was from 10 till midnight. So it was the worst time you could, and I had to close up the station after that and so on. But I took that opportunity to introduce myself to jazz, because it's way beyond big band. And I went in confusion to the library and began at the A's and went to the Z's. And it took me 2 years to listen to every album as I went along. So that's how I learned that jazz is made up of so much improvisation and instrument variations that it was a good education before I finally got an opportunity to switch over to a better slot after someone was leaving here to do blues in 83.
Would you say blues music is your real passion for, in terms of choosing a genre?
Again, no. The opportunity came up and the slot was better. I believe it was 7:30 till 8:30 was an hour show or so. I was following an ardent blues broadcaster, Nick Greenwood, and he was leaving to go back to England, actually. And it was all vinyl. Vinyl. So I had to learn blues from that. And so I really went deeply into the history of the blues as its general history. But as far as music is concerned, I just chose whatever. And we had a great choice of very rich music, which we still have in our library. So that was my introduction. And I gently fell in love with it more and more. And it took over in short time. I'd say within 6 months to a year, I was comfortable with it.
Beautiful. Wow. And I mean, here we are, CFRC celebrating 100 years. On October 7th, there's going to be a special event right outside the station. And you, along with Jim Birch, are going to be honored with over 40 years of consecutive broadcasting. How does all this feel to you?
I was thinking, I give that a great deal of thought, because 40 years gone by, you wonder, all of the whys come into the picture. Why am I staying? Why am I doing it this way? And really the big why is sending out music to people who are, don't forget, blues is originally known as, in the speaking of genres, as a music of truth and a music of healing. And so I went with that a little bit, but mostly my aim was to bring music that was somewhat current and aimed toward the student body that I was broadcasting for. And from a student level here at the station, there were old-timers that were all other than myself involved. So blues grew on me, and I wouldn't say passion until a few years after that, and then it's been a passion ever since. Because of the history catch-up, as well as just the general sound of the music, which I like.
Sometimes life ain't what you expect it to be. It can throw you things you cannot see. No matter how heartbreaking.
And how do you feel about the importance of campus and community radio in today's landscape?
Well, there are still so many old-timers. Kevin Michael, Dave Kuhn, and others that have left, Roger Eccleston. And these guys had put in their 10, 12, this 25 years for Kevin. And Jim Birch, of course, has stuck with myself for 40 years. So as far as community is concerned, I think what is broadcast is for the general benefit of community and campus, but campus is still foremost. I feel that I'm among youthful people here all the time because I'm older than them. But it gives me pleasure to be involved with that group of listeners. But I do know that there are a strong base of older community people out there because I get phone calls, I meet them over the years. It's become, because I've been to 26 blues fests here in Kingston since it began, I see the audience and I have attended all of them. So therefore it's alive out there in the community side of things as well as the, I don't know right today about the student group of people that are listening. I'm really not sure, I haven't got a good handle on that. Although the people that have, there are younger people that say, oh, I've listened to you, I catch your show, and you've been around a long time, yes, yes, yes. So someone's listening in the age group that's, as well as every other genre, that there's many genres. There weren't that many genres back then. So it's changed a lot. But as I mentioned earlier, the music that I'm playing today, I think my talent is my ears. I have a good ear for listening to the riffs of blues. And I've also become attuned to my own healing as well. You know, it's good for me. I get a solid fix every Saturday night from 6 till 8, sorry. And so I'm comfortable continuing on. And I hope that that's what I'm sending out is music of truth and healing.
Amazing. Any special memories you'd like to share of doing this show? I know you've got lots of stories from having spoken to you.
I think the biggest benefit that I've had from doing music at CFRC is I'm treated as a media, which I say personality. And so therefore, I've been allowed through that to get behind the scenes. A lot of different artists, big ones, some are dead, some are, most of them are alive. I met Coco Taylor, Taj Mahal, Johnny Winter. So these personal meets are very important to me, and they stand out because of the rarity of these Americans coming into Canada back then. I see it's lessened a lot since COVID. It's mostly Canadian in the fests. And so that would be my other memories. I did start out, campus radio is considered an entry level into the industry for not the genre, but radio engineering, as well as musicianship going. So as far as musicians are concerned and artists, which I have a deep respect for, and that's where my heart is with the artists, that I began at the beginning interviewing them readily. So I started out with a lot of interviews with David Rotundo, trying to think of a few more, but they were Paul Reddick. So these guys were here as young as they could be, setting up in that room there and playing their instruments, and I would give them a quick interview, and that was about, you know. And actually, they were here on a Saturday night because I wouldn't do it. Pre-recording was non-existent going quite a ways back. So it was all live, and I tried to catch the artist that came here on a Saturday night. And so I would say, can you get over to the station at 6 o'clock, and we'll do a half an hour of interview with you and so on, and play your music and tell them which bar you're playing at tonight to give you a boost in the audience attendance, which was fun. It was a really good thing to do.
Well, the Blues Project, every Saturday night from 6 to 8, right here on CFRC, celebrating 100 years on the air.
There were two goals that I had in mind going back, let's say 10 years ago. I wanted to reach the 40-year target, and I wanted to reach the 100-year target as well.
You got both.
I did. And so I'm not going to wither away because I've met my goals, but I'm still so pleased that I'm able to participate in something like this and the 100th anniversary.
Excellent. Well, Wayne, thank you very much for spending some time with me today to talk about and reflect back over these 40 plus years here at the station.
Well, thanks for inviting me, and I hope to see you around as well for many more until I don't do it anymore, which I hope is a long time away. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. I'm Kareem Mosna in Kingston, Ontario. You are tuned to Viewpoints.
And it's time to take a quick peek at some of the stories produced by a journalist all over the country through our Periscope. We start things off in Knowlton, Quebec, where the organizers of the 12th Literary Festival confirmed that they are back with an in-person edition. The festival will run from October 20 to 24 at Knowlton's Community Center. The festival had switched to virtual mode during the last couple of years. This year's festival will feature a mix of local and national authors, meets and greets, and they will also hold a poetry workshop. Journalist Taylor McClure spoke with Jane Livingston, president of the Knowlton Literary Association.
We've got authors coming from all across the country. We have Louise Penny, who will be with us. She will, in fact, be interviewing a very well-known mystery writer by the name of Peter Robinson. It turns out the two of them are quite good friends, and they're colleagues, of course. So she's one of the big features with Peter. One particular author that I'm most excited about is David A. Robertson, who has been a youth adult writer. He's from the Cree Nation in Winnipeg. He's written a trilogy of, I guess you'd call it, fantasy literature for kids, about a young brother and sister who get fostered into a home, and they then start on an adventure through a closet door. But he has just come out with a new novel, The Theory of Crows, which I think is largely autobiographical about his growing up as a First Nations and the influence that his father had on him and the times they spent together in nature. He will not only be talking to adults at the community center, but he's going to Knowlton Academy to talk to the kids, and he will be going to Massey Vanier to talk to the secondary school students as well. He's a very dynamic guy.
The play Bunk Number 7 hits the road in British Columbia to share the residential school experience. After nearly 20 years in the making, the story of Bunk Number 7 will finally be told across northern BC. Bunk Number 7 is a play written by the late Larry Gounod, which tells the story of a group of boys who were involved in the 1961 riot at the Edmonton Residential School. The story is based on some of Gounod's own experiences in the school. Morgan Budden in Terrace, BC, speaks with Marianne Brorup Weston, who directs the play.
In 2001, I met Larry Gounod, and at that point decided to form a First Nations theater company. And Larry had a story to tell, and the story was about his time at Edmonton Indian Residential School. The play was almost ready in 2005 to premiere in Toronto at the Native Earth Performing Arts, which is Canada's biggest Indigenous theatre company. At that point, Larry suddenly passed away, and there was one rewrite left. So that's 17 years ago, and all this time, I've been trying to find a way, and that way is now. I'm pretty confident this show will be taken to another level.
The first showing of Bunk Number 7 will be held on September 29 at the REM Lee. The cast and crew will then hit the road and visit 8 communities, touring from October 8 to November 15. And the play will be presented in cities such as Rupert, Smithers, Prince George, Dawson Creek, Fort Nelson, and Fort St. John. And our final stop is in Ontario, where the First Nations Cable Company presented an update to the Six Nations Elected Council on its current project to bring fiber internet and to provide better service to the community. First Nations Cable Representative Jeff Thomas said the project is well underway, with two of the three phases of the project completed. Thomas was hopeful to have the system ready by September 5th, but he said that the project had been pushed back a month due to a hardware issue with Hydro One. The company hopes to be up and running on October 3rd. Thomas called this project a phenomenal feat. In Oshawa, in Ontario, Andrew Dow is with Jeff Thomas.
That's 100 gigabit link that we've established. That's a phenomenal feat. And it's something that there's, I know, municipalities that are crying for something like this. So it's a link of the future. It's not just a Band-Aid or just enough to suffice what our needs are now. What we're building is something for the future. I talked to the Hydro guys. They told me they're going to get into this DWDM, they call it. One fiber, which we have active right now, that's going to be for 100 gigabit link. We'll be able to run 72 fiber or 72 gigabit links on the one fiber. That's how advanced this technology is. So something in the future, we don't know what's ahead of us. One good thing that COVID really brought into everybody was it identified all the problems on the network. And it doesn't matter who they are, how big they are, how small they are, everybody had trouble with their networks. And COVID proved that to everybody. So this link we're building is something out of the future. So I'm pretty excited about that. It's something that is needed here and will sustain what our needs are in the future.
First Nations Cable is in the process of finalizing a contract with the government of Ontario that will fund this project, which Thomas said will be worth $11 million. And this completes this edition of Viewpoints. Our journalists this week, Karen Musna, Megan Dooling, John Roon, Andrew Dow, Morgan Budden, and Taylor McClure. National Coordinator, Maureen McEwen. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. My name is Boris Chassaigne. Happy to have you with us. Take care.
Abakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints. Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI and get all our stories on canada-info.ca.